Welcome to the Food Professor Podcast, episode 37. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Sylvain Charlebois.
Sylvain, we got a great episode coming up. We've got, of course, our Trying Stuff segment. This segment, we've got Sprague Soups from
soups.
Canadian Soup. What a great... It's an incredible story. We'll talk about it, and there's interesting things happening in the category, and of course we'll be trying a couple of their soups, so stay tuned for that. And we've got a great guest, Corey Mintz, who let me find his book here.
I got his book right here.
Yeah, we got his book. There we go. Corey Mintz. And it's funny because you get to be on the other side. He used to ask you questions as a food reporter. And now we get to ask him questions about this great book. I've had the chance to go through it. The Next Supper, The End of Restaurants as We Knew Them, and What Comes Next.
So, we'll so much getting... information in there. I was overwhelmed.
I'll mention this to Corey, but he starts the book, and it's a very familiar story for me. He talks about having a meeting arranged with a restaurateur, and then it all gets canceled on March 16th. I had a podcast interview scheduled with the same restaurant entrepreneur the same day.
You're kidding?
Wow. Because it was all coming out of the Restaurants Canada trade show, right? So
of course,
some PR folks had lined up a bunch of interviews, and they all collapsed.
Yeah.
So it just, like the first page of the book, I'm like, oh my God, you and I were on, you know, very similar paths. She was going to be on our podcast, actually. So
some of the language, like I've spoken to Corey before, but some of the language is pretty, you know, it's consistent with what you could hear in a kitchen of a restaurant. I'll put it that way.
Let's jump into the news. So, first of all, let's talk about research from the lab. You're talking about salmon. Yep. I love salmon, and the industry loves salmon because it's one of the proteins that is a perfect breakfast, lunch, and dinner protein. Like
absolutely.
It's such an interesting thing. I mean, you mentioned on I forget which podcast it was. Oh, when you were on Remarkable Retail with Dave Marcotte, you said, you know, it's a bit weird. We feed salmon chicken. And so, you know, when I looked through your research, a lot of people are confused about salmon. But what did you learn from the research? Because it was asking consumers about their understanding of salmon. And why don't we talk about that and what you discovered in the research?
Well, data is showing that wild is still it. I think everyone actually appreciates wild, but the reality when you walk into a grocery store, most of the time, 90% of the time, you're going to be offered farmed salmon. That's basically it. So we wanted to dig deeper into how much people know about aquaculture and farmed salmon. And by the way, Michael, the reason why we released the study now, it's because 2022 is the International Year of Aquaculture and Artisan Fisheries. So basically a couple of months ahead of that year, we thought of actually starting a conversation about salmon, and our results have been published in different newspapers, which is great. But the point is that people are mystified. I mean, they don't necessarily understand aquaculture all that well. And when you say that it is common practice to feed salmon chicken and canola and other stuff, people are a little bit shocked. I remember when I was moderating a panel in October in Wolfville, and I had a couple of experts in the salmon industry commenting on the future of sustainable production in the sector. One of the CEOs said, "Well, we actually feed salmon chicken," and you could feel in the audience people were surprised and frankly a little bit shocked. And I was shocked too, because I probed further. Well, how did that happen? Well, it's a cheap protein. It's an available protein. And between you and I, it's not the best parts of the chicken that is fed to salmon. It's the rest, quote unquote. Mm. So feathers, beaks, legs, all that stuff. So it's you kind of wonder what's going on there. But that is approved by the CFIA. It's of course there are restrictions, clear restrictions. I must say it really got a lot of conversations going as a result of that. But I think we need to do a better job explaining how aquaculture works, because I received tons of emails from people just telling me a lot of things. And frankly, I wasn't even sure it was true, because it's still a bit of an obscure industry. I don't know if you know much about aquaculture, Michael, but next week I'm visiting for the first time in my career, I'm visiting a facility where salmon is actually produced, and I've never been invited before until now. And so so I'm visiting a Sustainable Blue. It's close to Wolfville right here. The CEO's name is Kirk Havencroft, a great guy. So you'll be giving me a tour of the facilities. I'll be asking questions about feed, but he does not feed salmon chicken. And so I want to know why, and why are we actually doing this in industry overall? But I do want to thank my colleague for the study, Stephanie Colombo, who's a research chair in seafood nutrition. She's amazing, and she's very knowledgeable, really. And she knows this stuff, and probably we'll invite her on our podcast at some point in the new year. But she really just unpacked the whole issue of aquaculture, all the myths related to aquaculture. And certainly if anyone wants more information about salmon production, I would contact Stephanie Colombo at the Faculty of Agriculture at Dal. She's just amazing. And the work that she's doing with her team is really influencing practices in the industry.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, let's move on from salmon. Let's talk about dairy. Catch us up on what's going on in dairy. Now, I saw you on social media kind of rapping on a few people's doors saying, you know, I'd really like more information and I can't really get a call back. So, and the second thing is last week, the big announcement from our friends at Lactalis, Mark Taylor, who's been a guest on our show, that they're going to try and get through a 15% increase to the grocers. That doesn't mean they're going to be successful, by the way. Let's talk about.
I think it's part of their strategy, right? it's a poking strategy, but it's kind of odd that Lactalis came up with the same number I did. I did say 15% many times, and they came in with 15%. As you say, it doesn't necessarily mean it will happen, but pressures are there. I mean, costs are going up for Lactalis, for Saputo, for restaurant operators, for everyone, really. I mean, and depending of how they do, how they manage their costs, it either will impact prices at retail, or you may see more consolidation, or you may see more companies shop south, go south to buy dairy proteins. And it has happened before. But what's funny about the CDC, I've been in discussion with them and I never got a reply ever until I tweeted to the Minister of Agriculture.
Very direct.
I mean, listen, I'm trying to contact this Crown Corporation we have. You're responsible for this Crown Corporation.
We pay their salaries.
We pay the salaries of 80 employees there. What's going on? And I kid you not, Michael, within hours, I started to get replies and replies from the CDC. So since then it's been helpful, but obviously, so I did get the names of accounting firms that are supporting the CDC, but both firms have actually said that they can't really disclose anything. Yeah, I have to talk to the CDC. So that's one thing. The other thing that's happening right now is that they are asking me to fill out a report in order to have access to that primary data. So, and I
freedom
should get
of access report. Your freedom of access report.
No, it's actually a research report. So, as a researcher, you kind of explain what you want to do with the data, and then you submit it to the CDC. And so, we'll see what happens. I haven't had the time, obviously, to fill out the form. It's a lengthy form, but at least there's some sign of life, which I appreciate.
You got some momentum, right? You're getting some answers, like one way, shape, or the other. I mean,
and I must say, I appreciate that, to be honest, because without, like, not even a reply in 2.5 weeks, seriously, come on. But at least I'm getting some love, and there is a discussion going on between us and the CDC. And if I tell you what, Michael, if we can get access to that primary data, this is going to be great for us, because we'll be able to really dig deep into. Now, how things are decided, and you probably saw Global News report this morning. We do know now that the Dairy Farmers of Canada were requesting a much higher increase. And so we believe it's over 15% at Farmgate, not 8.4. Can you imagine 15?
Well, it actually is a good segue to my next thought, not question, is you know, this back to, is Stats Canada measuring price inflation properly in the food category? Because I believe your food report for your food price index report comes out on, do I want to say December 9th?
Yeah.
December 9th. So we have an episode, I believe, on December 8th. So maybe you'll give us a bit of a preview, or maybe we'll talk about it in the subsequent one. Absolutely.
Well, we were planning to release it on December 8th, but I have a bit of a personal rule on December 8th, which is John Lennon's death. So I don't want to release. It's just one of those things, you know, out of respect. December 1st for AIDS Day, December 8th, and December 6th for Polytechnic as well. So those are days don't release the study for.
Well, actually, now that I think of it, if I look at my calendar, we record on the 8th and release on the 9th. So I think it'll all come together. So
yeah, absolutely. You'll get a copy ahead of time.
Beautiful. We'll dive into that. Now, I want to get to our Trying Stuff segment. Well, one thing before we get to Trying Stuff, what's going on in PEI with their potatoes? Like, I'm reading some potato fungus issues, something. What's going on?
I'll tell you. I mean, I feel for our potato farmers in PEI. So two farms are affected by a wart, which is, it's been around for 20 years on the island, and they've been very careful. The science was actually taking care of both situations, to be honest. But politics are now involved, and so the federal minister, Madame Bibeau, felt it was in the best interest of the country to basically issue a ban on one province, which is PEI, to save everyone else. So it's not being accepted quite lightly on the island, to be honest. And Mike, so regardless of who's right and who's wrong, okay, my concern is the reputation of the island itself, the food island of Canada. I actually think that this could be damaging for Prince Edward Island's reputation when it comes to potato growing. Potato production. That's my biggest concern right now. And I'm hoping that the federal minister is doing everything she can to make sure that the ban actually is lifted. Those two farms, I mean, they've been working on this since November 2nd. They could have isolated the two farms. No, none of these potatoes would have left the island regardless.
Yeah. Yeah, it is an island after all.
But
yeah.
Apparently, according to the minister, it wasn't enough.
All right, well, let's keep on the track on that, and let's hope things work out well.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish our potato growers in on the island all the best. Seriously, this is their canola versus China situation. This is like mad cow for them. This is like hitting the dairy sector in Ontario. This is a big deal for islanders.
All right, let's jump in now to our great interview with Corey Mint. So you know him. As I said, he's interviewed you. This is our chance to interview him. And he talks about, in his book, many of the themes that we've talked about.
We're going to grill him.
All right, let's get to that. Corey, welcome to the Food Professor Podcast. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. I'm full of caffeine. How are you?
I'm full of soup, actually.
Yeah,
Savannah and I just finished having some soup. We're excited to have you join us. And where are we finding you today? We're so Van's in Halifax. I'm in Toronto. Where are we finding you today?
You are finding me in East St. Paul, which is a suburb of Winnipeg. I live in Winnipeg, and my mother and father-in-law, Gordon and Olga, live in East St. Paul, and I drop our daughter off here in the morning, so I decided to stick around here to do our talk.
Wonderful. Well, thanks again for joining us. And Sylvain, and you know each other, but from different sides of the mic, right, Sylvain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Corey and I, we've spoken several times over the years. I can't remember the last time, but it's been a while. So I was very pleased to see Corey accept our invitation to talk about his new book, which was super interesting.
Yeah, super. I like what you did there, Sylvain. You're very clever.
you picked it up, eh?
Yeah, I like what you did there. Corey, why don't we jump right in? Tell us, first of all, before we get into this great book that you've just written, tell us a bit about yourself, your background, what you do, and your connection to the food industry and restaurants.
I guess I started cooking in terms of my career. I went to cooking school when I was about 20, and I went because I didn't know what else to do with myself. I had dropped out of high school without telling anyone and didn't tell anyone for another 20 years. I was living with my girlfriend who had scoliosis, and she had spinal surgery, and was in bed for many months. And I took care of her, and I learned to cook, you know, because somebody had to make nutritious meals. And I experienced what many people discover at some point in their food journey, which is the transformative power of food and the ability to communicate love through food. And it just, you know, at a point in my life where I was confused, lost, you know, a young man of maybe 19 or 20 and already had a feeling of failure, just discovering that I was good at something just invigorated me. So that's why I went to cooking school. And I cooked for a number of years, about 6 or 7 years, in, you know, all kinds of kitchens, and catering, and vegan meal delivery, high-end Italian, low-end vegetarian. I was a chef briefly of a small vegetarian restaurant in Toronto. And I reached the end of that career knowing I was never cut out for it, really. Mm. Like, I was never going to be great. I work with enough people who I could tell, you're going to be great. You're going to be great. Mm. And it was just at a certain point, it was time to get out. Realized I'd reached the end of the road. And I thought, well, I always wanted to be a writer. Maybe I'll try that. Yada, yada, yada. I became the restaurant critic for the Toronto Star within a year of that.
Mm. Wow.
Within a year of like cooking at a dinner theater 3 nights a week and saying, I got to try something new. I got that gig, and it changed my life and changed my career. And I did that for a couple years, you know, a dream job, restaurant critic, segued into column writing. And eventually, after I did a story that I'd wanted to do since my first day as a writer, which is about this sort of paradox in which the fancier the restaurant, the less the cooks are paid, I finally was able to do that story and do it properly for the Globe and Mail. And once that was published, my career kind of like the steering wheel just took a hard turn. That was my focus, not just labor, but the variety of systemic issues involved in food and restaurants.
Mm. Hey, let me just, I want to unpack one thing you said. Like, what is it that you said, I'm never be, or I'm not going to be the chef? What is it that you see in people that makes them, you know, a great chef? What is it? What is that it thing that you observed, and what is it that you characterize as, wow, you're a great chef and you're going to be a great chef?
Well, at the time, I mean, I was working with almost everybody was younger than me in the kitchen, first of all. So there was one guy who started who was 10 years younger than me, and we were at the same level, and I could see him already climbing past me so fast, you know, as I sort of, as I got a promotion from Garmanger to Antipasta, by that same time, he had worked every station, you know? Mm-hmm. And I could look around and see, not just about talent or you're going to be this quote unquote great chef, but like, you have the talent, the drive and the commitment and the ambition, you know, like when I go home, I'm tired from my 12-hour day. I want to watch, back then I was like, I want to watch The Daily Show and go to sleep and wake up and try to brace myself for doing this all over again. And they were going home and like spending 2 hours reading cookbooks and reading, you know, blogs, and everything was about food and getting to the next level. And sure enough, all those people are in positions of authority in a variety of kitchens all over the world.
The one thing, if I may, I mean, I'll just pretend Corey's not talking to us right now. There's lots of great critics in Canada, but what's unique about Corey's approach, I think, and you can pick it up while reading his new book, The Next Supper, is that he's a critic that really sees the big picture. You know, beyond the food. Corey will look at humans and humans interacting amongst each other, and he will look at the economy, how it's evolving or not evolving, and it makes his work very interesting to read.
Well, and it makes the book very interesting to read, and the book is The Next Supper, The End of Restaurants as We Knew Them and What Comes After. So congratulations on writing a book. That's a heavy lift, man. Tell us about the journey about writing the book and why you thought there was a space in the shelf for what you had to say in a book form.
You know, I realize when you say the book title out loud that I've been saying it wrong for the last week. I've been saying The End of Restaurants as We Knew Them and What Comes Next. Although I think that's probably a pedantic thing to pick out. I guess they mean the same thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to look at the big picture, and I guess the way the book came about is in the challenge of trying to think big about all of these issues, and me getting to the point after 3, 4, 5 years writing about all these problems and coming up against two limitations. One is, the budget of Canadian newspapers and magazines, you know, will say, we would love a big reported feature about how all of the halibut on the west coast of Canada is being privatized. We can afford to pay $600 for that. So how much time, how many days, how many weeks can you afford to spend to do that kind of reporting when that's the budget you had? And I was coming up, and $600, by the way, is usually about double what people would offer, you know? So I was coming up against that limitation, and also just like the scope. I mean, you know, an editor is going to say, can you do it in 1,000 words?
Right.
And you can't, right? You can't tell, you can't tell Four Seasons of The Wire in a Christmas special. At a certain point, you reach the stage where your work or the conversations you're having with people or talking with editors looks like the conspiracy theorist with the corkboard with all the red string, and you are saying, you got to look at the big picture. All these things are connected, at which point you either need to, you know, calm down, take some medication, talk to your therapist, realize that you're, you know, you're being paranoid, or you need to show your work. You know, you need to actually show, here's how all these things are connected, and let me present it to you in a digestible, readable, user-friendly format, which is, you know, the stage at which you go, okay, I need to write a book. And I was fortunate enough to connect with friends who advised me, and an editor and a publisher and an agent who helped me shape those sometimes sketchy ramblings into something that is, I think, a cohesive narrative and a structure, you know, the way we break down the book into the variety of 8 different restaurant genres to say, here are restaurants that all operate very differently, restaurant segments, and let's look at some of the issues that orbit them.
I mean, your book does read a little bit like a diary, but you do provide some hard historical and economic facts. I mean, you can feel that you have a lot of experience. You've been around with anecdotes. You talk about specific people without necessarily mentioning their names. great stories overall. But you do often come back to this issue of salaries, welfare in the industry per se. And you talk about menu prices and this, what I would call this social contract that should exist or could exist between society and the industry itself. Do you think, I mean, is this a manifesto, is your book a manifesto about a broken contract, or was it ever there?
I mean, I think part of the answer is in the way you phrase the question. I think it's built on a bit of a shady premise. You know, I think the industry is the foundation is on exploitation. You know, I mean, the whole imbalance in wages and the tipping system, it's structured around the idea that, you know, pre-restaurants, before we had a hospitality industry, we had servants. You know, in North America, we had slave labor. We had enslaved people who worked for free. And we turned that into a system where we could avoid actually having to pay for the labor of the people we need to do the work. I mean, that is a pretty sandy foundation on which to build a business. Yeah, I don't think it was ever fair. And I had, just yesterday I got an email from a hospitality professor, a food and beverage teacher at George Brown, my alma mater. And he I thought, oh boy, it's cooking school teachers going to be, because I used to get these messages from people. I don't get them anymore, but from sort of chefs who would say like, oh, why are you talking about the bad stuff? There's so much good in this industry. Mm-hmm. And I don't get those letters anymore, but he sent me this letter that said, in a paraphrase, I have it here. He says, the restaurant business model is and has been broken for a long time. There is no business in any industry that can be sustainable in any way as long as there is a legislated minimum wage set below the poverty line. And that's been effect in all our lifetimes. You know, if the idea is the government has set up this economic scheme where they say you can pay people not only less than the poverty line, but less than the legal minimum, which is already below the poverty line. And then customers will fulfill this fantasy where they're they're the boss and they get to decide how much your workers earn. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is not a broken system. That's a, you know, that's a thing that when you got it from the store, the pieces weren't all in the box.
Yeah, no, well, it comes out a lot in your book. You also talk about the stagiaire system in Europe. I feel you're not a big fan of it. So I guess I how do you track talent beyond, you know, a system in which you volunteer? I guess you're not paid to work in a venue, but you're aspiring to become a great chef. So what would be the ideal portal for people looking at this industry?
Yeah, well, I mean, at the risk of being hypocritical, I think two things can be true at once. And sometimes, you know, when I hear from people who are saying, like, I'm a young person, I'm interested in a cooking career or a food writing career, I will say, much as I am, I don't think the sort of institutional level staging where you're running a restaurant where you need the free labor, as is common at the quote unquote world's best restaurants in Europe, I'll encourage people, go do that, because it's not something that's available if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or whatever else. You can't just go knock on a door of most professions and say, I have a good attitude, I'm willing to work, I'm humble, will you let me spend a day or a week here? You can do that. And at the very least, yes, you can find out if this is for you. Or you can find out, if you do that at a couple places, how the environment differs. What's unhealthy about that is the idea that these are, you know, when people go and they do that for a month or 2 months or 6 months or a year at some of these places, that creates opportunities that's only available for those people who are able to do that, right? Who are the people who have 6 months to work for free and to pay for their own room and board in Spain or wherever it is? You know, that's just such an economic advantage to a certain segment of employees. I mean, I think the way that you attract and retain talent is, it's not a mystery. We're starting, you know, the Globe and Mail had this funny headline the other day.
Oh, I know, I saw that.
There was like, you know,
we've come up with the magic solution for the industry. Yeah. It took us
pay people more.
Pay people more.
Yeah. As if someone had finally discovered the alchemy of turning lead into gold.
Right,
it turns out that paying and compensating staff fairly, and I'll tell you, it's not, you know, this is, I know that you trade more in data than in anecdotal evidence, but, you know, I've spent 6 or 7 years talking with people about these issues. And I've definitely spent the last 2 years focusing for the book. And one of the things I focused on is like, hey, I can't write this book and just say, here are all these problems. I'm Mr. Bad News, right? I have to look for solutions. And in doing so, and solutions that diners can support the way they choose to dine. Mm. But in doing so, you know, I found restaurateurs operating under a variety of different structures that are different or a challenge to the old hierarchy or orthodoxy. And when I talk to those restaurateurs, when I send them a text or a message saying, what's up, how are you doing with staffing? They say, we're having no problems. All our people are here. They're happy. We're growing. And we have no problem attracting, and we have no problem retaining people. If anything, this couple, restaurateurs in Boston, they were saying, you know, they opened with this sort of, open book management profit sharing model. And as a result, the whole purpose was to create better jobs that people wanted to stay in because they were aware of all these issues. And as a result, their restaurant just kept growing because the attrition problem of having a half staff turnover, they had the opposite. They're like, our people stay with us and they keep getting better. So we have to create new opportunities for them. So we open a second restaurant, not because we're like, oh, we're big, we want to expand our brand, but because we're like, well, this is the only way to hold on to our great people is to create new opportunities for them.
I gotta say, your book is gutsy. One example, your BS detector section.
That was wild.
It is wild. I mean, you drop names, like you drop company names, like it's really audacious. So, I guess do you think that the industry can be believable at some point beyond the BS that we often see?
I mean, two things about that. One, it's not that I name names. It's that I just quote the corporate social responsibility pages.
I know. Yeah.
This is material that they have published online, right? This isn't me
doing. Make it so obvious, though.
Yeah. They they publish these things, and not like 30 years ago, like 6 months ago. It's wild to the extent that I was fortunate. I got to record the audiobook myself, which was so much fun. Mm. And over a week of recording, when I was reading those, here's what this company, Buffalo Wild Wings, says on their corporate responsibility pages, I heard the audio engineers gasp. they're like looking at the page. Does it really say that? And then listeners, you'll just have to go either go look it up or read it in the book. It is wild. But but the answer to your question is embedded in there in the sense that, like, while I was looking at those pages trying to say, how can I come up with some sort of formula in which I can sort of share with the reader, like, here's how to read these pages, here's how to decipher them. And I never expected to find anything as shameful as that Buffalo Wild Wings page. But at the same time, I never expected to find anything as admirable and best in class as the Cheesecake Factory page. In fact, I had repeatedly, while I was in the book proposal stage, I kept using Cheesecake Factory as a placeholder for, like, I'll do something with them just because I think the name is so funny. I want to eat. Like, to me, that seems like the perfect sort of big chain restaurant to focus on. And I was surprised in speaking with sustainability experts when they would drop the name of Cheesecake Factory and they say, actually, they're one of the people doing the best jobs. And when you look at what they're doing, you see why. They're not just saying, we try to source sustainable. They have this list of goals that they're trying to meet, of dates that they plan to meet them, of how far they are to them. And if you go and you look at that stuff, you go, oh, well, this is what you have to do. Because when you read that page, that builds trust, right? I mean, it's not shady. It's transparent. And I think that's how you earn it. I don't know. I mean, the question of, like, is it not possible for restaurant brands to get our trust or to keep our trust? Like, I mean, the way they usually get it is through flimflam, right? It's through the sort of charisma of either their charming chefs or their sort of marketing, you know, branding strategies of saying, you know, implying, like, we're good people, stick with us.
Right.
And I think probably there was a lot of chefs in smaller restaurants that coasted on the sort of nose to tail era of saying, like, well, seeing as we serve whole animals, you can just kind of trust, like, everything else is on the up and up, which I'm not accusing anyone, but I think I know that a lot of diners kind of made that assumption for a number of years until they went, oh, it turns out that's not the case. The only way to achieve trust is through transparency.
You know, your writing style, the book and our discussion reminds me of one of my favorite authors and writers of commentary, Anthony Bourdain. And at the end of Anthony's work or shows, as much as he was critical or optimistic, he always ended with this optimism of restaurants and the food industry, and it's power, it's magic to change and to bring light to dark areas, to revitalize neighborhoods. Do you see optimism coming out of this? As you know, as you say in the book, you're not just chronicling the flaws, but you also have solutions. Out of all this, out of all the work, out of all the in-depth work that you've done that went into this book, can you extract from that optimism for the sector, and where does it leave you as you look forward?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bourdain was, for people who only knew him as a TV personality, he was a great writer. And that first book, it certainly had an impact on me, as it did on many young cooks of that generation and subsequent generations. But that book was certainly... The narrative was he was being a firebrand, right? He was he was writing a tell all, and it was kind of a burn it all down type of thing, while still very much working within the industry. Yeah. And I knew going into this that couldn't be the objective. One, because, well, you can't do better than Bourdain, and two, because that's not constructive, and people are looking for answers. And I went looking for answers, and I feel like I found a lot along the way. But at the very end, I found more reason for hope beyond what's in the book, because we finally had to put it to bed at some point about 6 months ago. Mm. And the thing that's happened since has been, well, one thing that was happening pre then, and it's been happening since the dawn of the pandemic, which is consumer awareness. You know, I mean, my ambition with the book was to get people to become aware of some of these issues, to get them to believe me that I was not just chicken littling, and to care about these things. And the pandemic, in its disastrous effect on the hospitality industry, just put high heat on all these issues and brought them bubbling up to the surface, where the public could see the income inequality, where the public could see the exploitative nature of the third party delivery companies. So that's happened. So now you have a much more engaged dining class, and at the same time, you have a much more empowered working class, in the way that 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when I started focusing on labor and restaurants, you know, cooks still, it was almost everybody just wanted to talk to me off the record. Everybody was afraid of not just losing their job, but being labeled an agitator, a complainer. Right. And that has completely changed, right? I mean, the beginning of the pandemic, workers got a case of the fuck it's, and they said, you know, I'm doing something else for a living. I'm going back home. Yeah. Whatever the reason was, they were like, I'm not afraid to talk shit. And since then, you know, it was no surprise, talking with workers over the last year, that many of them were not going back, because once I put the, you know, once I was done the last edit of the book, I immediately got back in touch with everybody just to say, how's it going? What's going on? And I was hearing from like a good 30% of people saying like, I'm not going back, or I'm going back, but a third of my friends are not going back. So it was no shock when the industry found themselves operating on skeleton crews. And, you know, fast food franchise operators tried to drive that narrative that, oh, people are lazy, they don't want to work anymore. But the reality is there's a subtle workers' revolt. And I think hospitality employees have the opportunity to negotiate in a way that they never have before. They have leverage. And so my optimism comes from the hope that workers will kind of, and this is the piece I wrote for The Globe last week, will see the opportunity not merely to get $2 or $3 extra an hour, because that's now on the table, but to say, okay, if employers are now desperate in the way that they never have been before, let's talk about all the other things we want to see change about the industry that are not just about money or financial benefits, but about getting your schedule 2 weeks in advance and having HR policies. There's a real opportunity in the empowerment of workers and the awareness of diners, and particularly if they can kind of connect, you know, whether it's through social media or just that public awareness, the idea that they can support each other and say, hey, we actually give a shit about this industry changing.
Well, it's right back to Sylvain's point about the social contract. Listen, this has been, you know, I think we could, Sylvain, we could have this discussion for many hours, because this is such, you know, such a great discussion. Corey, you're such a great great observer and chronicle of the industry, and we really appreciate you joining us on the podcast. Once again, our guest is Corey Mintz, and the book is The Next Supper, The End of Restaurants as We Knew Them, and What Comes Either Next or After. We'll you know, maybe you can change the title.
And Corey, 10 years from now, we'll invite you back to see if you were right.
I don't know. I don't feel like we're going to see if he's right. We're going to see if the industry has changed, actually. I think
that's right. Exactly.
The book really rings true. I encourage everybody to buy it. We'll put links in the show notes. So, Corey, thanks again for joining us. A real
Thank
treat.
You, Corey.
Pleasure. Anytime. You.
Well, welcome to another episode, edition of Trying Stuff, where Sylvain and I, under no obligation, brands are sending us stuff. It's not a sponsored part of the episode. It's just us, A, having lunch together.
Exactly, yeah.
And B, you know, we get to discover new products and hopefully maybe give them a little bit of sunlight in the industry. That's also our objective as well.
Our Trying Stuff segment, Michael, is like having a date, you and I, but someone else pays the bill.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and thanks to all the brands who've sent product in.
And absolutely.
If anyone would like to send us more, please do. And we basically, we've got a bunch of them, and we try them in the order we get them, just to be fair. So we've got a bunch of stuff. So today we are talking about a soup, Canadian soup, Sprague soup.
I got a bisque, simple bisque. Tomato bisque with roasted red peppers and cream. And also, I'll be trying the organic soup, Tuscany style minestrone. What about you?
I will be trying the triple bean chili, love chili, and the simply green, which is broccoli with cream coconut and curry. I'm not a big soup guy, I gotta admit. I don't eat a lot of soup. I make a powerhouse French onion soup. I used to eat soups. I eat less of them now. you know, bit of a preview to the review. These are amazing. And yeah. What a backstory. You know, let's talk about the product. Let's look at the packaging. Is, you know, okay, here's right off the top, pull tabs.
Yeah. Oh, on that the soup. Is just lovely. Yeah.
I love that because I'm essentially lazy. And, you know, the packaging's fantastic. It's very interesting. But the backstory to this soup, I didn't really have any idea. It goes back to
1925.
Yeah. And it is currently run and operated by Rick Sprague, who's the latest member of the family. It's made in Belleville, Ontario. So Prince Edward
place.
County.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the only soups made.
I've driven by their plants, but I've never actually visited, unfortunately.
Well, we'll have to rectify that because there's not a lot of these plants left in Canada, right? I mean,
I know.
Made in Canada. It's very unique. And it's, I was reading the backstory, and what they've done is focus on organics and whole. Like they said, well, listen, rightly so, we're not going to compete against the Campbells of the world. We'll let them do what they do. But they really, really focused on ingredients. So, I mean, again, you know, it's not uncommon for us, you know, USDA organic and just a bunch of labels, kosher and
so it's ready to serve. And the one thing I've noticed is all of the cans we receive are plant based.
Yes.
And they're very proud of that. And they're very proud of the fact that they use Saskatchewan grown lentils and pulses, which is really awesome. So it's truly Canadian. I mean, it's a Belleville based company, but it embraces Canada's commodities overall.
All right, so let's try.
So can we eat now?
Let's try. I'm going to try this
now.
What are we doing on this podcast? All right, so there is. I'm holding up to the camera, for all the folks listening, we have a YouTube channel. Check it out. I'm trying the Simply Green soup with broccoli cream.
My bowl is too big, so I can't. I don't want to bring it, but I'm going to try the minestrone Tuscany style minestrone soup first. I'm like you, Michael. I'm not a big fan of soup. I like cream, but not soup. But this minestrone soup is amazingly tasty. The vegetables, they feel fresh. It's not mushy. You know, it's fresh. It's just like it was made yesterday, really. But it's in a can.
Yeah, listen, this broccoli, it's got a snap to it, if I could describe it that way, like a freshness, as you said. But it's also got a bit of seasoning to it. Like I've had broccoli soups before because I like broccoli soup is one of the few I like, but it's easy to wreck it. And because broccoli, you know, it's not everybody's thing, but this with the, what has it got? It's got coconut and creamed coconut and curry. The curry just pops enough. There's a little hint of spice on your tongue. Love it.
Did you see on their package, Michael? It says it makes your spoon smile. Yeah, I love
It's making me, it's making me smile right now, I'll tell you.
So for my bisque, Michael, I'm adding a little bit a special. Remember these guys?
Yeah.
So I just basically sprinkle some cheese over my bisque. So let's see how that works.
Thank you to Cracker Barrel for their signature cheese blends. We've got a Trying Stuff review coming up next episode, I think, on the signature blends. Oh, how's that?
Oh, my God.
Good.
That bisque is amazing. Plant-based. So roasted red peppers and cream, the red peppers just pops in your mouth. It's just great. And I'll be honest with you that added cheese really is a good addition. Yeah. What about you?
Well, I took their triple bean chili here it is. There's the triple bean chili and I took it over the top. I love eggs. So I popped in, mixed in a couple of eggs. And even though we do have a lot of plant-based eggs that we review on this segment, as it happens, I love eggs. So let me just give this a try.
So these are real eggs, right? Eggs.
Real eggs and real chickens.
Yeah.
Real Burnbrae eggs.
So what's the score?
Oh, they're fantastic. This is just so fantastic. They just go with this chili. And again, the chili is, it pops a flavor. It's fresh. I love a good chili.
Yeah.
The egg adds just an extra ton of topspin to it.
It wouldn't be my first reaction. It wouldn't be the first thing I would do with the chili, but it's a good idea, a great idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that bisque, I think I've fallen in love with that bisque, to be honest. It's just, when I think of bisque, I think of lobster bisque, something fancy, red peppers, you know, would that excite you? but really super tasty, great stuff. Gluten-free, plant-based, all the stuff, very natural.
I'm just looking at Rick's background. He's Grant's great-grandson, fourth generation president, and he steered the business into these natural foods. So listen, congratulations to Sprague. Yep. These are fantastic soups.
Yeah.
You know, run, don't walk, and get them off, visit their site. And by the way, go into About Us, because they've got a little bit of About Us. But then when you go into the backstory of the full story, it's like 10 pages. It's a fantastic, basically, the history of Canada summed up in this food. So congratulations.
Their strategy is pretty simple, Michael. They're trying to make a boring category exciting again. That's basically what they're trying to do. And I can see their point when I taste their products, to be honest. I mean, it's just because when you go to the soup aisle, it really it's all familiar. I mean, it's gotten familiar, too familiar. But now with the packaging, with different flavors,
Well, all right, that's a wrap on this episode or edition of Trying Stuff. Sympathies and all good support out to our friends in BC.
The
environmental catastrophe. Now let's focus in on farmers. And I had a couple of questions right off the top. And you spent lots of time in Saskatchewan. How important is the rail to the food industry and farmers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll have an op-ed in the Globe. I think it's going to come out tomorrow or Friday about our supply chain's resiliency westward. About 70 years ago, the entire world was focused on Europe. We had a global, a Europe-centric global economy. So the St. Lawrence Seaway really served our economy quite well because Europe was right there. I mean, it helped Ontario, it helped Quebec. Us here in the Atlantic. But now things have shifted in Asia. I mean, Asia is really the economy, the growing economy around the world. And that's why, I mean, when you think about ports, Vancouver is number one in the country and Prince Rupert is number three after Montreal. It's even busier than Halifax right here. So when you put things into perspective, those corridors towards Prince Rupert and Vancouver are now more critical than ever. The Port of Vancouver actually sees for well over $12 billion worth of agri-food commodities a year. That's $35 million a day. Wow. That's a lot of food in and out, going in and out.
Because it's going both ways, right? Yeah, it's coming and going.
Of course, out, farmers, grains, commodities, beef, whatever, and in ingredients for processors across the country. So the entire country is affected by what has happened in BC, unfortunately. But I have to tell you, I mean, I feel for Abbotsford. I feel for the Fraser Valley. As you know, Michael, the Fraser Valley is the breadbasket of BC. And so those images, my goodness, they were heartbreaking.
Those farmers leading the dairy cows through the water. I mean, you know, that's
seriously,
that's got to be one of your pictures of the year.
Absolutely. You know. And so I feel that's my biggest concern. So hopefully they'll get back into shape because, I mean, these operations are very intensive. You need trucks to go there every single day or else you're wasting a lot. They've lost livestock. Yeah. On top of that, and I've worked on dairy farms when I was a kid, and we had names for cows. I mean, these are pets, and that's really heartbreaking to see what was going on there.
Well, we send them all the best wishes we possibly can, and things look like they're starting to turn around. I mean, there's a lot of resources being put in, but more rain's coming, so it's getting into the rainy season. So anyway, well, listen, we wish all the folks
we wish them all the best. Absolutely.
All right, well, that's a wrap on this episode of The Food Professor. Reminder to everyone, check out our YouTube site because we have some bonus content of our Trying Stuff segment, and we kind of chop our segments down into different segments so you can watch us eat food basically and talk about what we talk about. Be sure and check us out. So I'm Michael LeBlanc, president of Emmy LeBlanc Company and host of a bunch of podcasts and a cooking show, Last Request Barbecue. So check that out if you're into cooking and barbecue.
Appetizing, so appetizing. And I'm the food professor, Sylvain Charlebois.
And thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll look forward to talking to you our next episode.
Bye-bye.